The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Consulting Clarity, From Expertise to Buyer Problems, Offers, and First Clients. Topic: Introduction. At 7:15 a.m. in a small meeting room above a coffee shop in Chicago, you are staring at a blank proposal. The coffee beside your laptop has gone cold. The email that brought you here said only, "We need someone who can help us think this through." You know exactly what the sender means. Years of fixing processes, reading teams, and spotting weak points have taught you how to see the shape of a problem before everyone else does. But this morning, expertise is not enough. The cursor keeps blinking, and every blink feels like a reminder that being useful is not the same as being paid for. On the screen, the empty page is asking a harder question. Can what you know become something a client will recognize, trust, and pay for? Across North America, that question repeats in different forms. Marcus, a startup founder in Toronto, is watching customer churn rise and cannot decide whether the issue is product, onboarding, or pricing. Priya, a nonprofit executive director in Atlanta, has a board meeting in 2 days and still lacks a clean way to explain the numbers. Daniel, who runs a manufacturing business outside Milwaukee, is tired of fixing the same handoff failure every month. Nora, an accountant in Denver, sees these problems from the edge of the table. Her clients do not ask for consulting. They ask for relief from confusion, delay, risk, and missed opportunity. None of them is buying a resume. They are buying a better outcome. That is the first truth of consulting. In practical terms, consulting is the sale of expert analysis, judgment, and guidance tied to a business problem. It is not just being helpful. It is not casual advice at a dinner party. It is not a polished biography with a fee attached. A consultant is paid because the client expects a clearer decision, a safer next move, a faster diagnosis, or support through a messy situation. The value is real, but only when it connects to a problem the buyer already feels. That is why consulting has to be separated from neighboring kinds of work. Coaching primarily helps the client build capability. Freelancing primarily sells execution. Agency work often sells managed delivery. Consulting sits beside those models, but its center is different. It sells judgment. A buyer may want a coach to develop leadership skill, a freelancer to complete a task, or an agency to run ongoing production. The consultant helps make sense of a business issue that is too important, too uncertain, or too visible to handle casually. The difference matters because the buyer feels it immediately, even if the labels sound similar. The buyer problem is the real starting point. A buyer problem is not a broad area of interest or a field you know well. It is a pain point that a client can recognize, justify, and fund. Sometimes it is slow onboarding. Sometimes it is weak reporting. Sometimes it is a process that no longer fits the size of the business. Sometimes it is a team that has outgrown memory and improvisation. The problem does not need to be dramatic. It only needs to matter enough that delay feels costly. If the issue does not touch time, money, risk, capacity, quality, or attention, it may be interesting but not yet commercial. This is also where a few recurring terms begin to take shape. A diagnostic is the short, contained engagement that helps identify what is really happening before anyone bets big on a fix. A retainer is a recurring agreement for ongoing advice or support. Those shapes matter because consulting work can be packaged in more than one way, and the package changes what the client thinks they are buying. One engagement may be a close look at the problem. Another may be continuing access to judgment. Both can be useful, but they are not the same promise. In North America, many consulting businesses begin in ordinary places. They start with a referral from an accountant, a conversation at a startup event, a board member asking for help, or a former colleague forwarding a name. The market is crowded with people who can speak about expertise. What is scarce is clarity. A focused specialty is easier to remember, easier to recommend, and easier to defend when someone asks why this person and why now. The generalist may know more than the market can see. The specialist is easier to trust because the story is simpler to repeat.
That is the tension running through this entire audiobook. You may already know a field. You may have lived through difficult decisions, solved hard problems, and learned how organizations actually behave when pressure rises. None of that is wasted. It is the raw material. But a consulting business begins only when that raw material is shaped into something a buyer can understand quickly.
The challenge is not to sound impressive. The challenge is to sound relevant. So this book follows the path from expertise to offer, from offer to first clients, and from first clients to a practice that can keep standing after the excitement of launch fades. It will show how to recognize which problems are worth building around, and how to think about the shape of the work. It will also show how buyers decide whether they trust you, and why clarity matters so much when a first offer goes out into the world. The goal is not to turn consulting into a mystery. It is to make it visible enough to work. And at the center of it all sits a simple, unsettling question. Not whether the expertise is real, not whether the person has earned the right to help. The question is whether a buyer can see the value clearly enough to say yes. That gap, between what someone knows and what someone can buy, is where the story begins. End of introduction. Expertise can feel like it should be enough. You know a field, you have lived through hard decisions, you spot patterns faster than other people, and you can usually explain what should change. That is a real asset. But it is not yet a consulting business. A consulting business begins when that expertise connects to an urgent buyer problem, not a general area of interest, not a vague promise to help. A problem a client can recognize, name, and justify spending money to solve. The gap between knowing a lot about something and earning money from it is where many capable new consultants get stuck. That gap is not about intelligence. It is about commercial usefulness. A client does not buy expertise in the abstract. A client buys a better decision, a faster diagnosis, a lower risk plan, a clearer path through a messy situation, or support when internal capacity is stretched thin. Your knowledge matters because it changes what happens for the client. A practical definition is simple. Consulting is the sale of expert analysis, judgment, and guidance to help a client solve a business problem or make a better decision. The work may include research, interviews, audits, workshops, plans, training, or implementation support. Those are the forms. The core product is judgment applied to a specific business issue. That distinction matters because beginners often start in the wrong place. They begin with their background, their resume, or a broad list of things they can do. Buyers do not evaluate a consulting offer that way. They ask whether you understand the problem, whether the path sounds credible, whether the risk feels manageable, and whether the result is worth the fee. In North America, many consulting practices begin through networks, referrals, small business relationships, startup circles, nonprofit boards, and operating teams. In that environment, clarity travels faster than breadth. A focused specialty is easier to name. It is easier to recommend. It is easier to price. Most important, it is easier for a buyer to understand why you are relevant right now. Consulting creates value in several ways, and each one points back to the buyer's situation. Sometimes the value is faster diagnosis. A founder, executive director, department head, or operations leader knows something is wrong, but not exactly where the problem starts. Sales have slowed. Projects keep slipping. Employees are using different processes. The team has outgrown its systems. A consultant can enter with pattern recognition and ask better questions sooner. Sometimes the value is better decision-making. Clients often have several possible paths, none of them perfect. Hire or outsource. Rebuild the process or replace the software. Enter a new market or deepen the current one. Change pricing or improve retention first. Consulting helps compare options, clarify trade-offs, and turn a swirl of opinions into a structured business choice. Sometimes the value is reduced risk. A decision may be expensive, visible, or difficult to reverse. The client may not need someone to do every task. The client may need an experienced outside view before committing money, time, or reputation.
In that case, your value lies in spotting weak assumptions, missing information, implementation barriers, or unintended consequences. Sometimes the value is perspective. Internal teams carry history. They know why decisions were made. They know which personalities matter. They also inherit blind spots. An outside consultant does not automatically know more than the team and should not pretend to. The advantage is a different vantage point, combined with a disciplined method for turning observation into useful advice. Sometimes the value is support during implementation. A client may know the right direction but lack the structure, capacity, or confidence to move from intention to execution. You may help define the sequence, manage the change,
train the team, build the tools, or stay close while the first version is tested. Advice without movement often loses value. Good consulting keeps the result in view. The business becomes stronger when you understand which kind of value you provide most reliably. A consultant who diagnoses operational bottlenecks is not selling the same thing as a consultant who trains managers. A consultant who advises on market entry is not selling the same thing as a consultant who helps a nonprofit redesign donor reporting. These offers may all sit under the word consulting, but buyers experience them differently. That is why consulting must be separated from neighboring kinds of work. The boundaries are not moral judgments. Coaching, freelancing, agency work, and consulting can all be valuable. Many independent professionals blend them over time. But at the beginning, fuzzy boundaries make offers harder to explain and harder to sell. Coaching primarily develops the client's own capability. A coach helps the client think, reflect, practice, and grow. The coach may ask questions, create accountability, and help build skill or confidence. Consulting usually applies outside expertise to a defined business issue. The consultant is expected to analyze, advise, recommend, and often bring a point of view. The difference can sound subtle, but buyers feel it. A leadership coach may help a founder become a better manager. A management consultant may assess why the company's managers lack decision rights and recommend a new operating rhythm. Both may improve leadership. One develops the person. The other intervenes in the business problem. Freelancing has a different center of gravity. Freelancers often sell task execution. A freelance designer designs. A freelance writer writes. A freelance analyst builds a report. The buyer already has a defined need and pays for skilled completion. Consulting sells judgment, diagnosis, recommendations, and decision support. The consultant may still produce deliverables, but those deliverables are vehicles for thinking. This distinction protects you from becoming an expensive extra pair of hands when the buyer actually needs direction. It also protects you from pretending that advice alone is enough when the buyer really wants execution. If the client's request is to build a landing page, that may be freelance work. If the request is to explain why the conversion path is underperforming and what should change, that begins to look like consulting. Agency work often centers on managed delivery across a function. A marketing agency may run campaigns. A recruiting agency may help fill roles. A technology agency may manage a website, platform, or development pipeline. Agencies can be strategic, and many are highly consultative. But the agency model usually promises continuing production, management, or delivery capacity. Consulting may focus on advice, strategy, intervention, or implementation support without owning an entire function long term. A consultant might assess a marketing operation and recommend a new lead generation process. An agency might run the campaigns every month. A consultant might help design the customer success process. An agency or outsourced team might staff the function. The buyer needs to know which promise is being made. The cleanest early consulting offers do not try to be everything. They do not present casual advice as a business. They do not turn a hobby into a professional service by adding a price tag. They do not list every skill they have ever used and hope the buyer will assemble the value. A consulting business needs a problem, a promise, and a path. Casual advice is reactive and informal. Someone asks a question, and you answer from experience. That can build trust, but it is not yet a consulting offer.
A hobby may be serious and skilled, but it becomes a business only when the buyer problem, economic value, delivery method, and expectations are clear. An undifferentiated menu of services is even more dangerous because it creates the illusion of completeness. The more options you list, the more work the buyer must do to understand why any of them matter. A new consultant may think a broad menu increases opportunity. In practice, it often lowers buyer confidence. Strategy, operations, marketing, leadership, and growth support may sound impressive, but it leaves the buyer with a simple question. For what problem exactly? Buyers do not want to decode the offer. They want to recognize themselves in it. This is the commercial usefulness test. Being generally smart is not enough. Being experienced is not enough. Having helped employers in the past is not enough. Your offer must map to a specific pain point a buyer already feels or can quickly understand. If the buyer cannot connect the offer to a business consequence, the conversation becomes polite and unproductive. A pain point does not need to be dramatic. It only needs to matter. A small business may lose time because every customer handoff is improvised. A startup may need investor-ready operating metrics before a funding conversation. A mid-market firm may have grown into a process that no longer fits. A nonprofit may need clearer program reporting for funders and board decisions. An internal team may need an outside facilitator to resolve a cross-functional problem that keeps returning. Those client segments matter because consulting is not sold into a single kind of organization. Small businesses often buy practical help tied to revenue, time, systems, or owner overload. Startups often buy expertise that helps them move faster than their headcount allows. Mid-market firms may buy specialized support when the issue is important, but not large enough to justify a major firm. Nonprofits may buy help with strategy, operations, fundraising systems, evaluation, or governance processes. Internal teams may buy consulting through a department budget when a specific initiative needs outside structure. Each segment has different buying habits, budgets, language, and trust signals. A startup founder may respond to speed, relevance, and prior experience with similar growth constraints. A nonprofit executive may care about mission fit, stakeholder sensitivity, and practical deliverables. A mid-market operations leader may care about process discipline, risk control, and credibility with managers. A department head may need someone who can work within existing systems and produce a result that survives internal review. That is why the first founder decision is not what you can do. The better first decision is which repeat problem you can solve well enough to sell now. Repeat problem is the key phrase. You are looking for an issue that appears often enough, hurts enough, and fits your current capability well enough to support a first offer. A repeat problem gives the business a shape. It lets you learn from one engagement and improve the next. It lets you write clearer proposals because the work is not reinvented from scratch every time. It lets clients refer you because they can describe your value in ordinary language. A sentence like, "She helps small manufacturers clean up quoting and handoff processes," travels better than vague business consulting. The problem must be narrow enough to be credible, but not so narrow that no buyer recognizes it. For a beginner, that balance is practical rather than theoretical. If the offer requires a long explanation before the buyer understands the pain, it may be too abstract. If many different buyers describe the same frustration in similar language, the market may be telling you where to begin. Process cleanup is a useful pattern. Repeated market requests might sound like complaints about slow handoffs, unclear ownership, duplicate work, missed follow-ups, or team members relying on memory instead of a shared system. At first, those complaints may look like scattered operational mess. With attention, they can become a focused diagnostic and implementation offer. The offer might begin with a process audit. You review how work enters the system, who touches it, where delays occur, and which decisions lack ownership. Then you recommend a simpler workflow and support the first round of implementation. The buyer is not purchasing operations help in general. The buyer is purchasing a path from recurring confusion to a clearer way of working.
That does not mean every consultant should sell process cleanup. The lesson is the structure. A repeated request becomes a defined offer when you can name the buyer, name the problem, describe the outcome, and explain the delivery path. Without those pieces, you are still selling availability. With those pieces, you are building a business. Common consulting services tend to fall into a few structures. Diagnostic work identifies what is happening and why. Strategy work clarifies where to go and how to choose. Implementation support helps the client put the decision into practice. Training transfers knowledge or behavior to a team. Audit work compares current practice against a standard, requirement, goal, or better operating model. These structures can overlap. A diagnostic engagement may lead to strategy. Strategy may require training. Implementation support may reveal a need for a follow-up audit. But the initial offer should still have a clear center. Buyers need to know whether they are paying for insight, a plan, skill transfer, quality review, or help executing the change. Diagnostic work is often a strong entry point for a new consultant because it limits the first promise. Instead of saying, "I will fix your whole operation," you say, in effect, "I will identify the root causes and recommend the highest value changes." The result may be a written assessment, a decision meeting, a prioritized action plan, or a small set of implementation options. Strategy work carries a different promise. The client is not merely asking what is broken. The client wants a direction. That may involve positioning, growth planning, service design, market selection, organizational structure, or operating model choices. Strategy work requires you to separate attractive ideas from workable choices. A strategy that cannot guide trade-offs is just language. Implementation support moves closer to doing, but it remains consultative when judgment stays central. You may help sequence tasks, define owners, build templates, test a new process, or advise leaders as the plan meets reality. The risk in implementation support is scope creep. If every new task becomes yours, the engagement can slide from consulting into unbounded execution. Training has its own logic. The buyer wants a team to learn something, adopt a behavior, or apply a method. Training can be valuable when the issue is not just a missing answer, but a missing capability across a group. If you offer training, be clear about what changes after the session. Attendance is not the result. Better decisions, cleaner execution, or more consistent behavior is the result. Audit work is useful when comparison matters. You review current practice against requirements, standards, internal goals, or a defined best practice. An audit can be formal or informal depending on the field. If a field is regulated or licensed, stay within proper boundaries. Do not claim authority you do not have. Engagement structures describe how the work is packaged commercially. A fixed scope project has a defined outcome, timeline, set of activities, and fee. It works well when the problem is contained enough to estimate. A retainer provides continuing access or recurring support over a period of time. It works when the client needs ongoing judgment or capacity. Advisory access gives the client a way to ask questions, review decisions, or get periodic guidance without a full project every time. Workshops concentrate the work into a facilitated session or series of sessions. They can help groups align, decide, learn, or produce a specific output. Interim support fills a temporary role or leadership gap. In interim work, you may operate inside the client's organization for a defined period while still bringing outside expertise. Each engagement structure changes the risk. Fixed scope projects require strong boundaries because the work is promised in advance. Retainers require clear rules about access, response time, and what is included. Advisory arrangements require clarity about how advice is requested and delivered. Workshops require preparation, facilitation skill, and a defined output. Interim support requires careful agreement on authority, time, responsibilities, and handoff. Beginner consultants often blur service structure and engagement structure. They say they offer strategy sessions, but the buyer does not know whether that means advice, a plan, implementation help, or a workshop. They say monthly retainer, but the buyer does not know what happens each month.
The clearer path is to define both pieces. What kind of value is being delivered, and how is the engagement organized? Buyer motivation tends to fall into a few practical categories. Specialized expertise is one. The client needs knowledge that does not exist internally or does not exist at the needed depth. Temporary capacity is another. The client has capable people, but they are busy, overloaded, or missing a short-term role. Independent judgment is a third. The client wants a view that is not shaped by internal politics, habits, or incentives. A fresh point of view may sound softer, but it can be commercially powerful. Organizations repeat patterns because those patterns become familiar. You can ask why a report exists, why a meeting continues, why a customer handoff requires three systems, or why a service line is priced the same way it was years earlier. The value is not novelty for its own sake. The value is noticing what insiders have learned to work around. Buyers evaluate consultants through trust, clarity, relevance, proof of capability, and fit with the problem. Trust comes first because consulting often requires access to sensitive information, internal weaknesses, and unfinished decisions. A buyer must believe you will handle the work responsibly. Trust may come from reputation, referrals, credentials, prior relationships, visible thinking, or the way you conduct the first conversation. Clarity matters because confusion feels risky. A buyer who cannot understand what you do will struggle to defend the purchase. A buyer who cannot explain your offer to a partner, board member, finance lead, or executive sponsor may delay or decline. Clear language is not a branding accessory. It lowers the buyer's effort. Relevance matters because buyers do not hire the smartest person in the abstract. they hire the person who appears suited to this problem in this context. A consultant with deep enterprise experience may not be the obvious fit for a five-person company. A consultant who has only worked with early startups may not be credible inside a regulated mid-market firm. Fit does not mean identical experience. It means the buyer can see why your background applies. Proof of capability can take many forms. Case examples, testimonials, past roles, work samples, frameworks, diagnostic questions, workshops delivered, measurable outcomes, or a strong referral can all help. At the beginning, proof may come from employment history, volunteer leadership, pilot projects, or a small number of early engagements. The point is not to exaggerate. The point is to make capability visible. Fit with the problem is the final filter. You can be trustworthy, clear, and capable, yet still be wrong for a particular engagement. That is not failure. It is positioning discipline. Strong consultants can say, "This is not the issue I am best suited to solve," and either narrow the engagement or refer the client elsewhere. Early businesses grow faster when they resist poorly fitting work. The market increasingly rewards understandable specialties. Broad management advice still exists, especially among large firms and complex organizations. But many buyers now look for narrower expertise that maps to a visible problem. Independent experts, boutique firms, fractional leaders, and specialized advisors have become easier to find, evaluate, and refer because their offers are more specific. For a new founder in North America, that creates both opportunity and pressure. The opportunity is that a solo consultant or small practice can compete when the problem is narrow and the buyer values specialized judgment. The pressure is that generic positioning gets ignored. If many people can claim the same broad category, the buyer has no reason to remember you. Specialization does not mean you must choose a niche forever. It means your first market-facing version needs a sharp edge. You can expand after demand proves where your value is strongest. Many consultants evolve from a narrow offer into a broader practice, but they usually earn that expansion through repeated delivery, not by starting with every possible service. The beginner mistake is vague services. "I help businesses grow" may be true, but it does not tell the buyer where the help begins. Growth can mean sales, marketing, pricing, retention, product strategy, leadership, operations, hiring, partnerships, or finance. If the buyer has to translate the promise, the offer is not doing enough work. Another beginner mistake is creating too many deliverables before demand has been proven. New consultants often build elaborate packages, slide decks, assessment tools, onboarding portals, and service tiers before they have enough buyer conversations. Preparation feels productive because it is controllable. But the market decides what matters. A simple offer tested with real buyers is more useful than a beautiful package no one has asked for. A third mistake is custom work without a repeatable delivery path. Customization is part of consulting because every client has context. But if every engagement starts from zero, the business becomes exhausting and hard to price. A repeatable delivery path does not mean every answer is identical. It means your method has recognizable stages, decision points, and outputs. For example, a diagnostic project might always begin with intake, document review, stakeholder interviews, workflow mapping, root cause analysis, and a recommendation meeting. The findings vary by client. The path stays familiar. That familiarity improves quality, protects margin, and helps the buyer understand what will happen after signing. A fourth mistake is pricing without clear scope, assumptions, and boundaries. Price is not just a number. It is attached to a promise. If the promise is vague, the price will feel arbitrary. If the assumptions are hidden, the engagement will strain when reality changes. If the boundaries are unclear, you absorb extra work or damage trust by pushing back late. Scope describes what is included. Assumptions describe what must be true for the work to proceed as priced. Boundaries describe what is not included, what would require a change, and how decisions will be handled. These details may feel administrative, but they shape the economics of the business. They also protect the client from surprises. A minimum viable consulting business is much simpler than a full firm. It has one clear promise, one target buyer, and one repeatable way to deliver. That is enough to begin testing demand. The promise says what result or decision the work supports. The target buyer says who has the problem and authority or influence to pay for help.
The delivery path says how the work moves from first conversation to useful outcome. One clear promise might be to identify the operational bottlenecks slowing customer fulfillment. One target buyer might be owner-led service businesses that have grown beyond informal handoffs. One repeatable way to deliver might be a short diagnostic, a prioritized workflow redesign, and implementation support for the first process change. That is not a whole empire. It is a sellable starting point. The same logic can apply in many fields. A human resources consultant might begin with manager training for first-time supervisors in growing companies. A finance operations consultant might begin with monthly reporting cleanup for startups that need reliable decision numbers. A nonprofit consultant might begin with board reporting packages that connect program activity to funding decisions. A technology consultant might begin with software selection support for firms that have outgrown spreadsheets. The common thread is not the subject matter. The common thread is the shape of the offer. A buyer, a problem, a promise, and a path. Without those four pieces, the business depends too heavily on your ability to charm, explain, and customize in every conversation. With those pieces, the market can begin to understand what you are for. A strong first offer also makes referrals easier. People do not refer complexity. They refer a sentence they can remember. She helps startups clean up customer onboarding before churn gets worse. He helps nonprofits build clearer board dashboards. They help small manufacturers reduce quoting delays. These sentences are not slogans. They are commercial shortcuts. Pricing becomes easier for the same reason. A broad promise has no natural boundary, so the price becomes a guess. A defined problem with a defined delivery path can be estimated, compared, and improved. You can learn how long the work takes, where clients need more support, which steps create the most value, and which parts should be removed. Focus turns pricing from wishful thinking into business judgment. Delivery improves as well. Repetition lets you notice patterns. The third time you solve a similar problem, your questions become sharper. The fifth time, your process becomes smoother. The tenth time, your proposal, onboarding, templates, and recommendation structure carry lessons from every prior engagement. Specialization compounds because the work teaches you how to sell and deliver it better. None of this requires pretending that consulting is mechanical. It is not. Clients are human, organizations are messy, decisions involve personalities, constraints, incentives, and timing. But a consulting business cannot be built entirely on improvisation. The art sits on top of a method. The better the method, the more room you have to respond intelligently to the client's reality. That matters especially for beginner founders because early energy is limited. You may be building the business while still employed, recently independent, or between roles. You may be relying on savings, a small network, or a few warm relationships. You do not need a complicated firm at the start. You need a first version that can be explained, sold, delivered, and improved. A useful starting question is not what services you should list. It is what problem people already ask you to help think through. Pay attention to repeated requests. Pay attention to moments when people want your judgment before they want your labor. Pay attention to the issues that create cost, delay, risk, confusion, or missed opportunity for a specific kind of buyer. Then test whether the problem has commercial weight. Does the buyer see it as important? Does the problem connect to money, time, risk, performance, compliance, capacity, or strategic pressure? Does the buyer have a reason to act soon? Does solving the problem create a result that can be recognized? If the answer is mostly no, the issue may be interesting, but weak as a first offer. Urgency does not always mean panic. It can mean the problem blocks a decision, slows revenue, frustrates staff, threatens quality, weakens reporting, or consumes leadership attention. A buyer pays when the cost of leaving the problem alone feels higher than the cost of hiring help. Your job is not to manufacture pain. It is to understand the pain that already exists and show a credible path through it. The early sales conversation should therefore sound less like a performance and more like a diagnosis. What is happening now? Why does it matter? What has already been tried? Who is affected? What changes if the problem remains for another quarter? What would a useful outcome look like? These questions do more than gather information. They show the buyer how you think. When you answer, resist the temptation to display every credential.
The buyer needs enough confidence to continue, not your entire professional history. Connect your experience to the problem at hand. Explain the kind of pattern you have seen, the decision the client needs to make, or the process you would use to find the answer. Relevance beats volume. Your authority grows when the offer is narrow enough to be specific. Specificity lets you name the symptoms, the likely causes, the first questions, the common trade-offs, and the probable obstacles. Vague expertise stays at the level of encouragement. Specific expertise can say, here is where this usually breaks, here is what needs to be examined, and here is what a first engagement would produce. That specificity also helps you decide what not to sell. If a request sits outside your repeat problem, you can decline, refer, or reshape it. This discipline may feel costly at first because any paid work is tempting, but poorly matched work consumes time, creates stress, and teaches the market the wrong thing about your business. A focused practice is built as much by exclusion as by inclusion. Early consulting founders often fear that narrowing will shrink opportunity. In reality, narrowing usually makes the first opportunity visible. Buyers are surrounded by broad claims. They respond when an offer seems built for their situation. A narrow first offer does not prevent later growth. It gives the business a place to stand. The launch implication is direct. Your first workable consulting business is not defined by everything you know. It is defined by one buyer, one problem, one promise, and one delivery path. Choose the repeat problem you can solve well enough to sell now, make the value easy to understand, and let the market response teach you what to refine next. From here, the work shifts to pricing, outreach, and the first client conversations. You turn a sharp consulting idea into something a buyer can actually buy by narrowing it to the smallest version that can sell now and still be delivered cleanly. At launch, you do not need every service you may one day offer. You need the version that can win work, deliver the promised result, and avoid chaos afterward. That constraint helps because it keeps your early effort pointed at the two places the business has to prove itself: acquisition and fulfillment. Acquisition asks whether a real buyer sees enough value to say yes. Fulfillment asks whether you can produce the promised result at a profit without exhausting yourself or confusing the client. Anything that does not help one of those jobs can wait. Beginners often build the full professional package before the offer has been tested. The website gets polished, the service menu expands, the logo gets revised, and the slide deck gets elaborate. None of that is wrong by itself. It becomes a problem when it hides the harder question. What problem is a buyer ready to pay to solve? And can you solve it in a repeatable way? The first version of the business should be built around what affects a sale or a delivery now. A sale needs a buyer, a problem, a reason to act, proof of capability, and a clear next step. Delivery needs a scope, a method, client access, decision rules, timing, and payment. Those pieces sound plain because they are plain, but they are the foundation. Without them, early consulting turns into improvisation with invoices attached. Buyer and problem come before packaging. You choose one buyer type and one painful problem worth paying to solve. The buyer might be owner-led service firms, early-stage software companies, independent medical practices, regional manufacturers, nonprofit executive teams, or internal operations leaders. The problem has to be narrow enough that the buyer recognizes it quickly. One buyer and one problem does not mean one client forever. It means the first market-facing version has a center. If you speak to a small professional services firm, the language, proof, price, timeline, and sales path will differ from an offer aimed at a venture-backed startup or a mid-market operations team. The tighter the buyer definition, the less work the buyer has to do to understand why the offer matters. The problem also needs commercial weight. A buyer may find many issues annoying, but not every annoyance earns a budget. A problem becomes more saleable when it connects to revenue, cost, speed, risk, quality, capacity, staff frustration, customer experience, or leadership attention. If the client can leave the problem alone for another quarter without much consequence, the offer will struggle. It helps if the buyer already has language for the pain. They may not describe it as a consulting opportunity. They may say that every new client starts differently, proposals take too long, employees are chasing updates, managers do not have useful reports, or the owner is still approving work that should have been delegated. That language matters because it shows where the buyer feels friction. Once buyer fit is clear, the offer has to become plain. A plain language offer defines the problem, the result, the deliverables, the timeline, and what is not included. It avoids the soft blur of phrases like strategic support or business transformation, unless those terms are immediately translated into practical outcomes. The problem statement names the current pain. For example, new customers may be getting inconsistent onboarding after the sale. The result names what changes. The client gets a clearer onboarding process, defined responsibilities, reusable templates, and fewer preventable handoff failures. The deliverables explain what the client receives. The timeline explains when the work happens. The exclusions explain what the engagement does not cover. Exclusions are not negative. They increase trust. A buyer is more comfortable when the edge of the promise is visible. If the engagement does not include software implementation, employee performance management, custom design work, or unlimited revisions, say so before the project begins. Clear exclusions protect both sides from disappointment. The boundary is where a consulting promise becomes manageable. Boundaries state the assumptions behind the price and the method. They identify client responsibilities, access requirements, and decision points. Assumptions might include timely access to documents, availability of key team members, or a single decision maker who can approve the path forward. Client responsibilities might include scheduling interviews, providing data, attending review meetings, and choosing among recommendations. Access requirements deserve special care.
Consultants often underprice the work as if information will be easy to obtain. Then the project slows when documents are scattered, managers are unavailable, or the buyer cannot get internal agreement. A strong offer names the access needed to do the work well. It does not punish the client. It makes the conditions of success visible. Decision points matter for the same reason. A consulting project can stall when the client has not decided who can approve scope, accept deliverables, or authorize a change. The offer should say when decisions are needed and what happens if new information changes the work. Early clarity prevents late friction. Packaging turns expertise into a repeatable format. The package might be a named service, a diagnostic, a roadmap, a workshop, an advisory package, an implementation sprint, or a structured review. The name is less important than the function. A package helps the buyer understand the shape of the work before buying it. A name service can be simple and direct. Customer onboarding diagnostic is clearer than operations consulting. Board reporting roadmap is clearer than nonprofit strategy support. Sales handoff workshop is clearer than growth advisory. The best names do not strain for cleverness. They help the buyer identify the problem and imagine the result. A diagnostic works when the buyer knows something is wrong, but needs a credible outside assessment before committing to change. A roadmap works when the buyer needs sequence, priorities, and trade-offs. A workshop works when alignment or decision-making across people is the bottleneck. Advisory access works when the client needs periodic judgment rather than a full project. A retainer works when the need is recurring and the boundaries are clear. Repeatable does not mean rigid. Consulting still responds to client context, but the path should be familiar enough that you can explain it without inventing the engagement from scratch. If every sales conversation produces a completely new service, you are not yet building a practice. You are selling customized availability. A practical offer also has an operating model behind it. Prospecting creates conversations. Qualification decides whether the buyer, problem, timing, and budget are plausible. Discovery explores the pain and the desired result. The proposal translates that conversation into scope, deliverables, timeline, price, assumptions, and a next decision. Delivery produces the work. Approval confirms that the agreed deliverables have been accepted. Invoicing requests payment under the agreed terms. Payment completes the commercial cycle. That chain is the business. If any link is vague, the business strains. A founder who prospects well but qualifies poorly fills the calendar with weak conversations. A founder who discovers well but proposes vaguely creates confusion at the moment of commitment. A founder who delivers well but invoices late creates cash pressure. The consulting business is not only the advice, it is the full path from interest to payment. Qualification deserves more discipline than beginners often give it. A prospect may be friendly, curious, and impressed, yet still be a poor fit. Fit depends on whether the buyer has the problem you solve, recognizes its importance, can act within a useful time frame, and has enough authority or influence to move forward. A polite conversation is not the same as a qualified opportunity. Discovery is where the sale becomes consultative. The purpose is not to perform expertise for its own sake. The purpose is to confirm the business pain, the cost of inaction, the desired result, the decision process, and the buyer's ability to act. Good discovery separates curiosity from urgency. It also prevents you from proposing work the client does not truly need. The cost of inaction is especially important. If a problem continues, what happens? Does revenue slow down? Do customers wait longer? Does leadership spend too much time chasing updates? Does quality vary? Does a decision remain stuck? Does risk increase? A buyer pays because action now is preferable to delay. The discovery conversation should make that trade-off clear. The desired result also has to be concrete. Better operations is not a result. A faster proposal process, cleaner customer onboarding, clearer management reporting, fewer handoff failures, or a prioritized implementation plan can be a result. The more concrete the result, the easier it is to scope, price, and judge. The proposal should not introduce a surprising new idea.
It should translate the discovery conversation into a decision document. It restates the business problem, names the outcome, defines the scope, describes deliverables, sets the timeline, states the price, lists assumptions, and identifies the next decision. A strong proposal feels like a logical continuation of the conversation, not a separate performance. Starter pricing has several jobs. This is general business information, not financial advice. It helps you learn the market. It covers direct costs. It protects your time. In practice, this screens for clients who value the work. It also keeps you from accepting bad fit engagements simply because any revenue feels reassuring. Early pricing does not need to be perfect, but it does need to be intentional. Many new consultants price from fear. They imagine the buyer will reject any meaningful fee, so they make the number small and hope volume will compensate. That usually creates a different problem. Low fees attract clients who expect more than the budget can support. The consultant works too much, learns too little, and trains the market to see the service as inexpensive labor. Pricing also cannot come only from confidence. A high number attached to a vague promise does not become strategic because it is bold. Price needs a reason. The reason may come from scope, complexity, value, access, speed, risk reduction, specialized expertise, or the cost of alternatives. The buyer does not need to see your full calculation, but the offer should make the logic feel credible. Competitor pricing is useful as a market check, not as a script to copy. Public package pages, peer conversations, procurement clues, and buyer feedback can help you understand how the market frames similar work. But another consultant's price reflects that consultant's reputation, cost structure, niche, proof, capacity, and risk tolerance. Copying the number without copying the context is weak strategy. Competitive awareness keeps you from drifting too far from reality. If similar buyers routinely pay for a certain kind of diagnostic, workshop, or advisory package, that tells you something. If every qualified buyer reacts with confusion, that tells you something too. The market check helps you listen without surrendering your judgment. Value-based pricing becomes useful when the work can be connected to measurable revenue, cost savings, speed, or risk reduction. If a pricing project can improve margin, if an operations project can reduce rework, if a sales process project can shorten a cycle, or if a compliance review can lower exposure to costly mistakes, the fee can reflect more than hours spent. The value sits in the business result, not only in the consultant's effort. Value-based logic requires evidence and restraint. If the value is speculative, do not pretend it is guaranteed. If the client cannot measure the outcome, value-based pricing may be hard to defend. If the consultant does not control implementation, the fee should not assume full responsibility for results outside the engagement. Good value pricing ties the fee to a credible contribution, not to exaggerated promises. Fee structure should match the nature of the work. A project fee fits a defined scope with a defined deliverable.
It works well for diagnostics, roadmaps, audits, and structured implementation projects. The buyer knows the investment, and you can protect time through boundaries. The risk is underestimating the work, so assumptions and change rules matter. A monthly retainer fits ongoing advisory support, recurring review, fractional leadership, or continuing implementation guidance. It should define access, response expectations, included activities, and what falls outside the retainer. Without those boundaries, a retainer becomes unlimited availability disguised as stable revenue. A day rate can work for workshops, facilitation, intensive advisory days, or on-site work where the unit of value is a concentrated block of time. It is simple, but it can understate value when the preparation and judgment are substantial. A day rate should account for preparation, follow-up, and the fact that a booked day can prevent other paid work. An hourly fallback can be useful for uncertain or limited work, especially when the scope cannot yet be fixed. But hourly pricing has weaknesses. It can reward slowness, punish efficiency, and keep the buyer focused on time rather than result. If you use it, define when it applies, how time is approved, and when the work should move into a clearer package.
A value-linked fee fits carefully chosen situations. Part of the fee may connect to a defined business outcome, milestone, savings target, or success measure. This can align incentives, but it can also create disputes if measurement, attribution, or timing is unclear. Use it only when the metric is credible, the buyer can provide data, and both sides agree on what counts. Margin protection is not merely accounting. It is the habit of keeping the promise aligned with the price. Scope boundaries say what is included. Approval rules say who can request or accept changes. Revision limits say how many rounds are covered. Assumptions say what must be true for the work to proceed as priced. Together, those details protect the economics of the engagement. Revision limits are especially important for deliverable heavy work. A roadmap, workshop design, operating playbook, or report can be revised endlessly if the client treats it as open-ended collaboration. A reasonable revision process improves quality. Unlimited revision erodes margin and delays value. The offer should make the review process clear before the first draft exists. Approval rules also protect the client. When a project has one approved buyer, decisions move. When five people can casually redirect the work, the engagement becomes unstable. If broader input is needed, build it into the process. Do not let informal comments become unpriced scope changes. Proof assets reduce buyer risk. A buyer is asking whether you can handle the problem, respect the context, and produce something useful. Proof can come from prior results, sanitized work samples, testimonials, before and after comparisons, or a simple case example. At the beginning, proof may come from previous employment, volunteer leadership, pilot projects, or small engagements, as long as it is presented honestly. Sanitized work samples are often powerful because they show the shape of your thinking without exposing confidential information. A sample diagnostic summary, a redacted workflow map, a planning template, or a before and after process description can help a buyer imagine the engagement. The sample does not need to reveal client secrets. It needs to make competence visible. Testimonials help when they speak to the buyer's risk. Praise that says you are smart is pleasant. Praise that says you clarified a messy decision, created a practical roadmap, improved team alignment, or made the next step obvious is more useful. Good proof answers the buyer's hidden question, which is whether this person will make the situation better. Public content can support the sale when it helps the buyer decide. A short guide, checklist, sample insight, or practical explanation can show how you think and what problems you understand. The goal is not to become a full-time content machine. The goal is to reduce uncertainty for buyers who are considering whether to talk with you. A useful checklist might help a buyer spot whether their onboarding process is breaking down. A short guide might explain the signs that management reporting is no longer serving decisions. A sample insight might show three places where handoffs commonly fail in service businesses. Practical content works because it is specific enough to be useful and restrained enough to leave room for a real engagement. Content should not replace outreach at the beginning. Early consulting businesses usually need direct human conversations. Networking, referrals, and direct outreach create the first lead base,
because they bring trust and context into the conversation. A clear offer makes those channels work better because other people can describe what you do. Networking works best when it is not vague social motion. You are looking for people who know the buyer, feel the problem, or can introduce you to conversations where the problem appears. Former colleagues, vendors, accountants, attorneys, industry peers, association members, founders, operators, and nonprofit leaders can all become useful nodes in a referral network. Referrals are especially strong in trust-heavy work. Consulting often touches sensitive problems, weak processes, unclear decisions, missed targets, overloaded leaders, or internal conflict. A referred consultant begins with borrowed confidence. The introduction does not close the sale, but it lowers the buyer's perceived risk. Direct outreach works when the buyer type is named and the problem is visible enough to speak about plainly. Targeted outreach to named accounts is different from blasting generic messages.
It begins with a reason the prospect might care. The message should show relevance, name a likely pain, and invite a practical conversation. It should not require the buyer to decode a grand theory of your services. Online visibility supports acquisition rather than replacing it. A clear profile, a simple website or landing page, and useful public content can make you easier to evaluate. When someone hears your name through a referral or outreach message, they often look for confirmation. A clean online presence should answer the basics: who you help, what problem you solve, what result you support, how the engagement works, and how to start a conversation. A simple landing page is enough for many early practices. It does not need a complex brand system. It needs clarity. The buyer should quickly see the target client, the pain, the offer, the proof, and the call to action. If the page is beautiful but vague, it fails the business purpose. If it is plain but clear, it can work. Channel fit depends on the buyer and the offer. Relationships often drive local and small business consulting because trust travels through community knowledge. Referrals matter when the work requires confidence before the buyer can judge the details. Targeted outreach fits named accounts when the problem can be identified and the buyer role is known. Online discovery matters more for expertise-driven searches, where buyers are actively looking for a specialist. The acquisition sequence should stay simple. You identify a prospect, you qualify fit, you hold a discovery conversation, you frame the problem, you propose the next step. That sequence prevents two common errors. One is proposing too soon, before the pain and decision process are understood. The other is staying in conversation too long without asking for a decision. Framing the problem is the turning point. After discovery, you should be able to say what appears to be happening, why it matters, what a useful result would look like, and what kind of engagement fits. This does not require pretending to know the final answer before doing the work. It requires enough judgment to define the next responsible step. The next step may be a paid diagnostic, a workshop, a roadmap project, an advisory month, or a referral elsewhere. Not every conversation should become a full engagement. Sometimes the right move is a smaller paid assessment. Sometimes the buyer needs internal alignment first. Sometimes the problem is outside your focus. Good client acquisition includes the discipline to avoid false starts. Objections should be treated first as questions about scope, risk, trust, and value, then as questions about price. When a buyer says the fee is high, the real concern may be unclear deliverables, uncertain results, weak proof, a bad timeline, internal approval risk, or doubt that the problem is urgent. If you treat every objection as price resistance, you may discount when you should clarify. A scope objection asks what is included and what happens if the work changes. A risk objection asks what could go wrong and how the engagement reduces uncertainty. A trust objection asks whether you can do what you claim. A value objection asks whether the result is worth the fee. Only after those questions are addressed does the raw number become the real issue. Discounting should not be the default response. If the buyer cannot afford the full version, you can sometimes reduce scope, shorten the engagement, remove deliverables, or offer a smaller diagnostic. That preserves the connection between price and promise. A discount that keeps the same scope teaches the client that the original price was negotiable without consequence. Feasibility has to be tested in the market, not only in your mind. Enough buyers must recognize the problem. Enough must value the result. Enough must accept the proposed way of working.
If prospects agree that the issue exists, but do not see it as urgent, the problem may be real but weak. If they value the result but reject the format, the package may need adjustment. If they like the offer but cannot identify a decision maker, the target buyer may be wrong. The cleanest market test is conversation followed by behavior. Do qualified buyers agree to discovery calls? Do they describe the pain in their own words? Do they ask about timing, price, and next steps? Do they introduce you to colleagues? Do they say yes to a paid first step? Compliments are encouraging, but buying behavior is stronger evidence.
A concrete pattern makes the shift from broad expertise to focused offer easier to see. You might begin with the phrase, "operations help for growing companies." That sounds useful, but it is too broad to sell cleanly. A sharper version focuses on service firms that win clients but struggle after the sale, because onboarding is inconsistent. The named offer might be a client onboarding systems package for owner-led service firms. The problem is that new customers enter the business through improvised handoffs, unclear responsibilities, repeated questions, and preventable delays. The result is a clearer onboarding path that helps the team move from signed agreement to active delivery with less confusion. The deliverables could include an onboarding workflow map, a responsibility chart, a client information checklist, handoff templates, and a short implementation plan. The timeline would be stated before sale and tied to the buyer's ability to provide access and make decisions. The exclusions would also be clear. The package might not include full software setup, customer service staffing, custom legal documents, or long-term operations management. The boundary keeps the offer profitable. The client provides current onboarding materials, access to the people involved in sales and delivery, and a decision maker who can approve the revised process. You run the assessment, design the improved handoff, review it with the client, and support an agreed first version. If the client later wants software configuration, deeper training, or ongoing management, that becomes a separate engagement. Proof for this offer does not need to be theatrical. A sanitized before and after handoff map can show how scattered steps become a simpler sequence. A short explanation can show the hidden cost of inconsistent onboarding. A testimonial can speak to clearer ownership and smoother client starts. A public checklist can help a service firm recognize whether onboarding friction is costing time. The sales path follows the offer. Early leads might come from accountants, bookkeepers, fractional finance leaders, attorneys, web agencies, or other professionals who work with owner-led service firms. Direct outreach might focus on firms whose public materials show growth, but whose operational maturity is uncertain. A landing page would not say operations consulting. It would speak directly to the onboarding problem after the sale. In discovery, the questions stay close to the business pain. How does a new client move from signed agreement to delivery? Who owns the handoff? Where do questions repeat? What information is missing most often? How much leadership time goes into fixing preventable confusion? What would a smoother start change for the team and the customer? These questions reveal whether the problem is painful enough to justify the work. The proposal then converts the conversation into a bounded project. It restates the onboarding pain, defines the result, names the deliverables, states the timeline, lists assumptions, sets the fee, and gives the buyer a decision point. If the buyer hesitates, the objection is diagnosed before the price is changed. Is the concern about scope, proof, timing, internal capacity, or the value of the result? That example is not the only good consulting offer. It is a pattern. Broad capability becomes sellable when it is narrowed to a buyer, a painful problem, a result, a delivery path, and a manageable commercial structure. You are no longer asking the market to buy general competence. You are offering a credible path through a recognized business problem. Once clients begin saying yes, the business changes again. Selling proves that the offer has market appeal, but fulfillment proves whether the practice can survive. Delivery quality, approval timing, invoicing discipline, payment terms, and cash control decide whether revenue becomes a real business rather than a series of exhausting projects. From there, the focus shifts to basic setup, payment timing, and the operating habits that keep the work stable. Once a buyer can say yes, the work becomes an operating business. That shift is less glamorous than positioning or pricing, but it decides whether early revenue turns into a stable practice. You do not need a heavy corporate shell on day one. You need the simplest legal, tax, financial, and delivery structure that fits your jurisdiction, your risk level, and the scale of your launch. This is general information,
not individualized legal or financial advice. The setup principle is restraint.
Choose enough structure to operate properly, protect the work, meet local requirements, and get paid. Do not choose complexity because it feels more serious. Complexity has a cost. It creates filings, fees, decisions, and administrative habits before the business has proved what it actually needs. A first consulting practice should be easy to understand, easy to maintain, and strong enough for the work you are selling. North America does not have a single small business rulebook. Registration rules, tax obligations, business licenses, worker classification, employment requirements, and sales tax treatment vary by country, state, province, territory, city, industry, and client type. A consultant in Ontario may face different setup choices from a consultant in Texas, California, Quebec, or British Columbia. The practical lesson is not to memorize every local rule. It is to treat local compliance as part of launch design. A good accountant helps translate tax obligations into operating habits. That may include how to track income and expenses, when to remit taxes, whether to register for local tax accounts, and how to handle estimated payments. A good lawyer helps translate risk into agreements, entity choices, intellectual property terms, confidentiality language, and hiring or contractor arrangements. Neither professional should make the business more complicated than it needs to be. The right support turns vague requirements into concrete setup choices. The first question is usually not which structure is the most sophisticated. The better question is what structure fits this business as it exists now. A solo consultant with modest risk, local clients, and simple projects may need a different setup from a practice advising on high-stakes financial systems, regulated operations, healthcare workflows, cybersecurity, or large enterprise change. Scale matters, risk matters, jurisdiction matters, client expectations matter. Some founders begin as sole proprietors or similar simple arrangements where local law allows it. Others form a separate business entity, such as a limited liability company in parts of the United States, or a corporation where that is the appropriate local vehicle. The point is not that one form is universally better. The point is that the form should match liability exposure, tax treatment, administrative burden, ownership plans, and client requirements. A structure that is right for a 10-person firm may be wasteful for the first month of solo advisory work. Worker classification deserves the same discipline. As demand grows, you may want help with research, design, bookkeeping, operations, scheduling, analysis, writing, or delivery support. The tempting shortcut is to call everyone a contractor because it feels flexible. That shortcut can be risky. Labels alone do not determine the relationship. The actual working arrangement and local law matter. The broad distinction is straightforward, even though local tests vary. Contractors usually control how they work. They often serve multiple clients, use their own methods or tools, carry some business risk, and invoice under agreed terms. Employees are typically subject to more direction. They may work inside your systems, follow set schedules, receive training and supervision, and fall under payroll, withholding, employment standards, and remittance rules. The reality sits in the details. If someone is called a contractor but is managed like an employee, required to work fixed hours, integrated into the daily business, barred from other clients, and paid like staff, the label may not hold. The consequences can include tax, wage, benefit, penalty, or insurance issues, depending on jurisdiction. Classification is not a branding choice. It is a legal and operational fact pattern. When you use contractors, keep the arrangement clean. Use a written agreement before work begins. Define the scope, deliverables, timing, payment terms, confidentiality obligations, ownership of work product, and approval process. Agree on invoice terms. Document when deliverables are received, reviewed, approved, and paid. A contractor relationship should not rely on memory, casual messages, or goodwill alone. When you hire employees, use the payroll, withholding, reporting, remittance, wage, hour, leave, insurance, and record-keeping processes required by local law. Employee hiring can be the right choice when the work is steady, directed, central to the business, and recurring.
but it is a larger commitment than bringing in project-based help.
The business must be able to support that obligation beyond the excitement of one strong month. Written agreements are not a formality. They are how expectations become usable. Before work starts, your client agreement should address confidentiality, ownership of work product, payment timing, scope boundaries, approval points, client responsibilities, revision limits, and what happens when the scope changes. Confidentiality matters because consulting often touches sensitive information. You may see financial data, customer lists, employee concerns, strategic plans, pricing decisions, internal disagreements, or vendor problems. The agreement should make clear that confidential information is handled responsibly. Trust is easier to maintain when confidentiality is explicit rather than assumed. Ownership of work product also needs clarity. If you create a report, framework, workshop deck, process map, template, or implementation guide, the agreement should say what the client owns, what you retain, and what you can reuse. You need to protect the underlying method while giving the client the rights they reasonably need for the purchase deliverable. Payment timing belongs in the agreement before the first meeting, not after the invoice is overdue. Early consulting businesses are especially vulnerable to cash strain because the founder pays attention to delivery and postpones collection. That is backwards. Collection is part of running the business. Deposits help. A deposit at signing confirms commitment and gives the business cash before time is spent. Progress billing helps when a project runs over several weeks or months. Instead of waiting until the end, you invoice at agreed milestones. Monthly retainers help when the work is continuing, advisory, or recurring. The client pays for access or support during a defined period, and the agreement states what is included. A small consulting practice often stabilizes cash flow by moving away from open-ended hourly billing after the work is done. At first, hourly billing may feel safe because you are paid for time. In practice, it can create a lag. You work, then invoice, then wait. A cleaner model may use a deposit to begin, a progress invoice after a milestone, and a final payment before or upon delivery of the last agreed work. The result is not merely better bookkeeping. It reduces the amount of unpaid labor sitting inside the business. Accounts receivable is the money clients owe you. Track it closely from the start. Know which invoices are unpaid, when they were sent, when they are due, who approved them, and what follow-up has happened. Late payment should trigger a prompt professional message, not a month of quiet resentment. The longer an invoice sits, the more fragile the cash position becomes. Financial separation is another early habit that pays for itself. Keep business and personal finances separate from the beginning. Use a dedicated business bank account where available, a dedicated payment process, and bookkeeping that makes income, expenses, taxes, your own pay, and reserves visible. Even if the business is small, separation creates cleaner records and better decisions. A separate business account changes behavior. When client payments arrive in one place and expenses leave from the same place, you can see whether the practice is producing cash or merely producing activity. When business and personal spending are mixed together, profit becomes harder to understand and tax preparation becomes harder too. Reserve money for taxes as payments come in. Treat tax reserves as money the business is holding temporarily, not money available for spending. The exact reserve depends on jurisdiction, structure, profit, and other income, which is why accounting advice matters. Build a cash buffer for slow months, client delays, and operating surprises. Consulting revenue often arrives unevenly. A strong month can be followed by a quiet one. A signed proposal can stall while a client waits for internal approval. A final invoice can be delayed by procurement or accounts payable. A buffer protects the business from turning every delay into a personal emergency. Profit is not protected only by charging more. Profit is protected by reducing rework, idle time, unpaid invoices, poorly defined scope, and unfunded tax obligations. Those are margin leaks. They are quiet, common, and expensive. A business can look successful on paper while the founder is exhausted, underpaid, and carrying too much unpaid work. Workflow is the next stabilizer.
A consulting practice needs a simple system for intake, scheduling, file storage, meeting notes, task tracking, and client communication. It does not need elaborate automation at the beginning. It needs a reliable path that prevents missed details. If a prospect becomes a client, The same core steps should happen every time. Intake captures the basic facts. Who is the buyer? What problem are they trying to solve? What decision or result do they need? Who else is involved? What timeline matters? What information is available? Scheduling keeps meetings, deadlines, reviews, and approvals visible. File storage keeps documents findable and secure. Meeting notes preserve decisions. Task tracking turns conversations into action. Client communication makes progress visible. That system can be simple. A shared folder structure, a calendar, a task board, a notes template, and a clear communication channel can be enough. The mistake is not simplicity. The mistake is improvising a new system for every engagement. Repetition improves quality. If every client receives a different administrative experience, you spend too much energy remembering how the business works. Standard documents create the same benefit. A proposal template, an engagement letter or contract, an onboarding checklist, a delivery checklist, and an invoice template are enough to begin. These documents do not need to be ornate. They need to be clear, reusable, and aligned with the way you actually sell and deliver. The proposal template helps you move from discovery to decision without starting from a blank page. It should contain the business problem, the desired result, scope, deliverables, timeline, price, assumptions, exclusions, and next step. The engagement letter or contract turns the accepted proposal into working terms. The onboarding checklist ensures the client provides access, materials, contacts, and approvals. The delivery checklist helps you complete the work consistently. The invoice template makes payment terms unmistakable. A delivery checklist may feel too basic for expert work. It is not. Expertise suffers when small handoffs fail. Did the client approve the interview list? Were source materials received? Was the draft reviewed by the right decision maker? Were revisions included in the scope? Was the final deliverable sent in the agreed format? Was the invoice issued on time? A checklist protects attention for the work that actually requires judgment. Operating metrics tell you whether the practice is improving. Track sales pipeline value, close rate, average project size, billable time, and days sales outstanding, meaning the average time between invoicing and payment. Those numbers do different jobs. Pipeline value shows possible demand. Close rate tests whether the offer and sales process are persuasive. Average project size tests pricing and packaging. Billable time tests capacity and delivery economics. Days sales outstanding tests cash collection. Pipeline value alone can mislead. A large pipeline with a weak close rate may mean prospects are curious but not convinced. A strong close rate with a tiny pipeline may mean the offer works, but not enough people are seeing it. A healthy average project size with slow collection may mean the business is selling well, but financing the client's delay. Metrics matter because they show which problem to solve next. Use a monthly review to turn those numbers into decisions. Look at what clients actually bought, not just what they praised. Look at which outreach channel produced real conversations. Look at which proposals stalled. Look at where delivery took longer than expected. Look at which scope boundaries held and which ones failed. Then adjust positioning, pricing, and service scope based on evidence. This review should be honest but not dramatic. One slow month does not prove the offer is broken. One easy sale does not prove the market is endless. Patterns matter more than moods. If several qualified buyers ask for the same narrower version of the offer, listen. If several proposals stall at the same point, investigate the cause. If clients love the outcome but the work consumes twice the expected time, fix the scope, price, or method. Risk management belongs in the same operating conversation. Depending on the type of work, jurisdiction, client contract, and potential harm from an error, professional liability or errors and omissions coverage may be appropriate. This type of insurance is designed for claims that professional advice, mistakes, or omissions caused a client loss.
Some clients require proof of coverage before work begins. Others do not. The decision depends on risk, contract terms, industry expectations, and affordability. Insurance does not replace good scope, strong documentation, or responsible practice. It is one layer in a risk system. The first layer is choosing work you are qualified to do. The second is defining the engagement clearly.
The third is keeping records of recommendations, decisions, approvals, and client responsibilities. Coverage may add another layer when the risk profile justifies it. Capacity decisions should be made before exhaustion becomes the business model. Bring in help when demand exceeds capacity, when a task becomes repeatable, or when a specialized skill fills a real gap. The reason to add help is not that growth feels exciting. The reason is that the business can use help to protect quality, increase throughput, or deliver a stronger result. Start with the work that does not require your highest judgment. Scheduling, formatting, bookkeeping coordination, research support, note cleanup, data organization, template preparation, and production tasks may be easier to delegate than diagnosis, recommendation, and executive conversation. The more clearly you separate judgment work from support work, the easier capacity planning becomes. Early hiring usually works best in stages. When demand is uneven, subcontractors or contractors may be more appropriate than employees, assuming the relationship is structured and classified correctly under local law. Project-based help lets you test repeat demand, learn what to delegate, and avoid building a fixed cost base too early. Employees may make sense later when the work is steady, supervised, recurring, and central enough to justify the commitment. The first helper should solve a real constraint. Do not hire because you dislike a task for one afternoon. Hire because the task repeats, quality matters, and your time is better spent on selling, diagnosis, delivery, or client leadership. A repeatable constraint becomes a role. A momentary annoyance does not. A specialized subcontractor can also improve the offer. A strategy consultant may bring in a data analyst for a defined reporting project. An operations consultant may use a process mapping specialist. A marketing consultant may collaborate with a designer or research partner. The client should know who is involved when appropriate, and the agreement should address confidentiality, ownership, approvals, and responsibility for the final deliverable. Large team structures can wait. Elaborate branding can wait. Complex automation can wait. A wide service menu can wait. The early business does not need the appearance of a mature firm before the economics exist. It needs a narrow offer, a sales path, a delivery method, clean agreements, timely invoices, and a way to learn from every engagement. Branding becomes useful when it clarifies the promise. It becomes wasteful when it distracts from selling and delivering. Automation becomes useful when it removes repeated friction. It becomes wasteful when it automates a process that is not yet stabilized. A broad service menu becomes useful when demand has proven adjacent needs. It becomes wasteful when it hides the strongest offer. The first 90 days should stay focused on closing an initial set of clients, delivering well, collecting proof, tightening the offer, and refining pricing. Do not try to build the whole future practice in one burst. Your first 90 days are a learning cycle with revenue attached. During the earliest stretch, choose one niche, one offer, and one primary channel. The niche names who you help. The offer names the problem and result. The channel names how you will create conversations. That channel might be referrals, targeted outreach, a professional network, a local business community, a niche association, or a focused online presence. The choice matters less than the consistency. A founder who tries five channels casually often learns less than a founder who works one channel with discipline. Set a weekly rhythm. Outreach creates new conversations. Discovery calls test fit. Proposals convert real opportunities into decisions. Delivery creates the result. Invoicing turns delivered value into cash. Cash review keeps the business honest. Those activities should appear on the calendar every week, even if the exact balance changes. If delivery consumes the whole week, the pipeline dries up. If outreach consumes the whole week, clients do not get served.
The rhythm protects the whole business. A simple weekly pattern might include dedicated time for relationship follow-up, a block for new outreach, space for discovery calls, protected delivery time, a proposal or review block, and a short cash review. The point is not to copy a calendar. The point is to prevent urgent work from erasing important work. A consulting founder is not only a consultant. You are also responsible for demand, delivery, administration, and cash. At the end of each month, review results without sentimentality. Which buyer type responded? Which problem produced urgency?
Which words did clients use to describe the pain? Which proposal was easiest to approve? Which work created the strongest result? Which engagement strained scope? Which invoice took too long to collect? Adjust the next month from that evidence. If clients keep buying a smaller diagnostic before they commit to implementation, make the diagnostic sharper. If prospects love the idea but resist the timeline, shorten the first step. If the best clients come from accountants and attorneys, deepen that referral path. If a particular deliverable creates most of the value, highlight it in the offer. If a service element creates rework without improving the result, remove it or charge for it. Pricing should mature through this cycle. Early pricing teaches you how the market reacts and how the work behaves. If every good fit buyer says yes too quickly and delivery is full, the price may be too low or the offer may be underscoped. If qualified buyers consistently hesitate because the result is unclear, the price may not be the real issue. If projects require more time than expected, you may need stronger boundaries, better intake, fewer deliverables, or a higher fee. The movement from hourly billing to deposits, progress invoices, or retainers is part of that maturation. Hourly work can help when the task is uncertain, but it often keeps the business attached to time instead of outcome. Deposits confirm commitment. Progress invoices reduce cash lag. Retainers stabilize recurring advisory work when the boundaries are clear. The best payment structure fits the way value is created and the way the client can responsibly approve payment. Client proof should be collected while the work is fresh. Ask for permission to use a testimonial, summarize a result, or describe the engagement in a sanitized way. Protect confidentiality. Remove identifying details when needed. Focus proof on the buyer's real risk. Did the work clarify a decision, reduce confusion, create a practical plan, improve a process, help leaders align, or make the next step easier? Proof is strongest when it shows useful change, not generic praise. Delivery quality compounds. Each project should improve the next version of the proposal, onboarding checklist, interview guide, workshop plan, recommendation format, and invoice process. Do not let lessons remain as feelings. Turn them into operating changes. If a client was confused by the timeline, revise the proposal. If approvals slowed the work, change the onboarding process. If scope expanded too easily, rewrite the boundaries. If payment lagged, change the terms. This is how a small practice becomes more durable. It does not become durable because the founder works harder every month. It becomes durable because the work gets clearer, the terms get stronger, the cash cycle gets tighter, and the offer becomes easier for buyers to understand. Growth should reduce chaos, not multiply it. The full path is now visible. You begin by understanding that consulting is not general helpfulness. It is expert judgment applied to a buyer's business problem. You narrow that problem until a real client can recognize it. You shape the offer so the buyer understands the result, the path, the price, and the boundaries. You create demand through relationships, referrals, targeted outreach, and simple visibility. Then you operate the business with clean setup choices, written agreements, separate finances, payment discipline, basic workflows, useful metrics, and careful capacity decisions. With those foundations in place, the practice can stand on its own and keep improving from one client cycle to the next. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.